I'm very happy to welcome as our guest in the Global Observatory today, Louise Arbour, who for the last 3 years has been the President and Chief Executive Officer of the International Crisis Group. This, of course, is just the latest in the number of high-profile positions she has occupied on the international stage, and they include being Chief Prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, a Justice on the Supreme Court of Canada, and United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Louise, that history gives you serious credentials to talk about the subject that will be the focus of the opening high-level debate of the General Assembly this fall, and that is the rule of law. I know you have very specific ideas about how you think that debate ought to go, what it ought to focus on, and also what it ought to avoid.
Yes, I'm very concerned that the rule of law is being reduced, I think, to some of its more familiar trappings, such as rule of law institutions, you know, police, courts, prisons, and that the rule of law is really used interchangeably with law enforcement, which, of course, it's a cheapening of the rule of law. And I'm afraid that the UN might be on the road to make the same mistake, in a sense, it did with elections, which is reducing elections to their mechanics rather than seeing them for what they are, which are substantive political events. So I hope that we could broaden the conversation about the rule of law to make sure that it's understood for what it really stands for.
Peace and justice, you know what that is shorthand for, this tension between these two concepts, two practices, with perfectly well-meaning people on both sides saying you must not sacrifice peace by insisting on justice, and others who say you cannot sacrifice justice for the sake of peace. Explain to me, please, your position on that, because I know it's a clear one.
I'm not certain that it's a clear one or that it's easily explainable. The first thing I think one has to say is that these two aspirations for peace and for justice are of equal merit. I think particularly in post-conflict or in countries where conflict is raging, the appetite for peace and the appetite for justice are perfectly legitimate aspirations. We should do everything we could to validate both. In common law legal systems, the one I come from, they are so interlinked that, in fact, a police officer is called a peace officer. And we talk about peace bonds and an order to keep the peace. The concept that justice is a kind of an element of peace is very, very clearly expressed. Now, in the international scene, particularly in conflict situations, we see a tension develop between the two. In large part, I think because we've made a lot of mistakes by using very facile rhetoric, like justice as an instrument of peace. Well, if we mean by that, you know, you indict a war criminal when you can't think of anything else to do in the hope that this will bring peace, which in the case of Milosevic, it did. In other cases, much more problematic whether it did or would have in the case of Gaddafi, for instance. So I think there's enormous confusion about how to have these two aspirations resolve. And in my view, they will both be better served if they are segregated, completely separated. I think peace mediators, to suggest that they should be negotiating either the indictment or the release of someone who's been indicted is ridiculous. They have no authority to do that. These are judicial processes. So I think separating the two tracks in the longer term will serve both best.
We're witnessing the beginning of fundamental transformations of countries across the Middle East and North Africa. As these countries struggle to reinvent themselves as more representative societies, is establishment of the rule of law an essential first step? And is it possible on that essential first step to try to guarantee that some of the bad things that can happen with institutions of law, which are then taken over by repressive regimes, don't happen? And finally, I wanted to add something that I learned today, which is this ICG insistence that solutions be contextual. Obviously, in these countries, systems of justice and systems of law may look quite different than the ones we have here. Is it important to make sure that the systems that are created are ones that are indigenous, that are contextual to their regions?
Yeah, very much so. I think to come back to the first part of your question, if by rule of law we understand law enforcement, rule by law, respect for law, a lot of authoritarian regimes are very, people are very law obedient. You'd better be. I just came back about a month ago from Myanmar, in a country that is now undertaking a major reform. In fact, probably the best news story of 2011, 2012. But I asked someone, just as I was arriving, whether it was safe to walk on the street. And you don't even have to ask. Yes, it always is. And actually, it may become a little less so as the country opens up. It's, a little chaos is often the price one pays for the relaxing of what I would call rule by law, tough, authoritarian law enforcement. So we need to be very clear that when we talk about the promotion of rule of law, we don't play into the hands of authoritarian regimes who will be very happy to receive more assistance for more law enforcement. When we talk about rule of law, we talk about equal protection, equal benefit of the law, equality before the law, no one is above the law. So these are concepts that are substantive, not formal. They talk about justice, protection of the vulnerable, protection of minorities, which are not otherwise guaranteed by pure electoral processes. That's what the law adds to democracy. It's protection of interests that majority rule doesn't always protect. That's the legal entitlements that protect those interests. That's what I think we need to promote.
There are new challenges to the rule of law coming from emerging threats such as transnational organized crime and illicit trafficking. How can international organizations such as the UN and also states adapt their responses?
Well, if you may be familiar with the work of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, of which I'm a member, which has been calling for the lifting of the 40-year-old taboo against questioning the whole wisdom of the war on drugs. In a sense, that's probably a very good example of a rule of law approach to a global problem. We are, in a sense, trapped, and we have been trapped in a repressive model. A model for countries of production, countries of transit, and countries of consumption entirely based on a repressive premise that we will win a war on drug. We will eradicate drug production and drug consumption by repression. And the empirical evidence is overwhelmingly that this has been now a nearly 50-year-old failure. It has produced none of its desired objectives. There's no reduction in consumption, in production, and in fact, the countries of production and transit are paying a catastrophic price, going to the extent almost of the destabilizing of the state itself in countries like Guinea-Bissau, now spreading into West Africa from, of course, a long-term devastating effect in Central America, for example. So again, what the rule of law, a kind of more substantive approach would require, is an approach first that is not based on ideological premises, that are based on, that is evidence tested, and that reflects fundamental public health policies, human rights values, and that doesn't buy in to a pure system of law enforcement and repression.
Finally, you wrote in a recent ICG Global post that as NATO prepares to draw down its forces in Afghanistan, the countries in the coalition ought to be incorporating the UN more in the overall dialogue, and you suggested an active role for the Security Council and the Secretary General. Tell us about that, please.
Well, I think, throughout the war in Afghanistan, there was a concern, I'm sure, that at the end of the day, the UN would be left to pick up the pieces. That if things didn't quite work out, or after everybody's gone, it's always the UN that's left, sometimes for decades, to pick up the pieces. So I think there might have been a kind of intuitive resistance in the UN playing larger a role than absolutely necessary. We think now at International Crisis Group that we have to reverse that logic, that in fact a proper, serious mediation role towards a transition and a longer-term support has to be owned by the United Nations, and that sooner rather than later, the UN should step up to the plate to not to be left to manage something that it will have had little role in creating, but to play a critical role in the mediation for the termination of the conflict and the departing of the alliance troops.
Louise Arbour, it's always a pleasure to see you in New York. In this particular case, a real pleasure to see you at IPI. Thank you.
Thank you.